Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 17th of July, these are our main stories. As India records 1 million cases of coronavirus, we look at how the authorities there and in another hotspot, Brazil, are trying to reduce infection rates. Enormous floods in China have driven millions of people from their homes. And
we actually voted and we elected this person. And then we felt that we were robbed, that he was stolen from us.
Anger in Russia's Far East over the arrest of an opposition politician. Was he detained for defying Moscow? Also in this podcast, EU leaders are discussing an $800 billion coronavirus recovery plan. But as usual, they're hugely split over how to spend it. And
I live in constant fear of my children being put in the same positions that I was, and traumatising them for the rest of their life.
How the legacy of colonialism still haunts the lives of many Indigenous Australians. Before we start, just a quick apology for some technical issues that meant the last podcast didn't make it into your feed. Sorry about that. We're trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, before the pandemic, few people outside expert circles spoke about disease doubling rates, but they do now. And here's one. It took India 6 months to register its first 500,000 coronavirus cases, but just 3 weeks to reach a million, a milestone it topped on Friday. So far, major cities like Delhi and Mumbai have been the worst affected. But now rural areas in the south, east and west of the country are seeing significant rises. India went into a nationwide lockdown in March when there were just a few hundred cases. It was lifted last month, but some medics, like Dr. Harjit Singh Bhatti from Delhi's Manipal Hospital, say that was a big mistake.
The reopening of lockdown is also a major cause for it, because first thing is that the lockdown period was not used appropriately for breaking the chain of transmission. And secondly, the lockdown was reopened without any further planning to how to control the virus.
While other people point to areas of progress, Dr. Harsh Mahajan is vice president of the National Federation of Healthcare in India.
There are some silver linings also. Delhi and Mumbai, the numbers are coming down. And in fact, only 25% of COVID beds are now occupied. India has had a very good case fatality rate, that it has been 2.5%. If you look at the US or Brazil, it's 3.9% and 3.8%.
But our correspondent in Delhi, Zubair Ahmed, says that if you look at the rate of spread, the figures are very worrying.
Every day's rise in cases breaks the previous day's record, with reports of cases coming from new areas, from smaller towns and cities. So that is where they are spreading now.
Now, a lot of politicians and medics across India I've been listening to have said that actually the death rates across India are comparatively low. Does that suggest that the hospitals are coping well?
Well, this is a very controversial subject in India. You know, the government has been saying that the death rate in India is very low and the recovery rate is very high. Of course, the recovery rate is high, there is no doubt about that. But the death rate is low. There are doubts because people know that health is a state subject. And in many state health departments, the numbers are not being kept properly. The COVID-19 patients who, after they die, are not being registered under COVID-19 deaths. So that's why many people believe the number of deaths being reported is low. The government has taken a number of steps to equip hospitals with new beds, new ICU units, ventilators, oxygen cylinders, etc. There appears to be no shortage of masks and gloves now, which was not the case earlier. New field hospitals have also come up in a very short time. But many government hospitals are bursting at the seams with a rapid increase in the number of new cases. We have been hearing horror stories on social media of patients dying after several hospitals refusing to admit their relatives. So Twitter, Facebook, Instagram are all full of personal accounts of people who lost their loved ones because hospitals refused to admit them. And that is the reality of Indian hospitals today.
That was Zubair Ahmed. Given that most countries across the world have eased their nationwide lockdowns, how can they control the virus still? Well, I asked our global health correspondent, Naomi Grimley, are local lockdowns the way forward?
Well, governments certainly like the idea better than a blanket lockdown because, of course, if you just isolate one particular area where the virus appears to be rife, that means the rest of us can then go about our normal lives or as near as normal in this post-COVID world. So that's why we've seen them in places like California, Spain, the Indian states of Bihar and Kerala, and also England in the last 2 weeks. Of course, the big thing that needs to be borne in mind is that you still need good testing alongside that so that you know exactly where the virus is, even within a small town. And also, of course, contact tracing. And as we've just heard, that also relies a lot on personal responsibility and people being willing to give up their details and possibly the details of their friends to the authorities.
Naomi Grimley, our global health correspondent. Large areas of central and southern China are experiencing their worst flooding in decades. At least 15 million people have been evacuated so far. Michael Bristow reports.
China experiences annual flooding, but this year has been far worse than usual. 33 rivers were at their highest ever level. More than 400 were beyond their warning height. Villages, towns and cities are battling rising water, including Wuhan, which earlier this year had to deal with the world's first coronavirus outbreak. The authorities say there's a rapidly increasing flow into the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River. State media said the dam's ability to manage floodwater is being tested.
Michael Bristow. Earlier this month, Russians gave President Putin the chance to stay at the helm of their nation until 2036. But with his approval ratings lower than they've ever been, they won't be years of docile subservience. Take the city of Khabarovsk in Russia's Far East, for example, where there are ongoing protests in support of a local governor after he was arrested on murder charges and then flown to Moscow. Our correspondent Steve Rosenberg travelled the 6,500 kilometres east of Moscow to find out why Russians have been taking to the streets.
Well, what is happening here in Khabarovsk is really unusual. Every evening this week, hundreds of protesters have been marching through the city, chanting slogans in support of the regional governor, who is now behind bars in Moscow. What is surprising is that unsanctioned demonstrations like this one are normally viewed by the authorities as illegal and have broken up. But so far, the police here have been keeping their distance. And for that, the protesters have been shouting thank you to the local police force. Just listen to that noise. We've been hearing that every night. Car horns sounding across the city in support of the protesters.
So who exactly is the man they're trying to help? Sergei Forgal, the governor of Khabarovsk region. Charismatic and popular. More popular here, some say, than President Putin. Last week, police came from the capital, detained him, flew him back to Moscow and charged him with involvement in multiple murders dating back a decade and a half. That sparked anger here. Alexander has been out protesting.
When our governor was arrested, everybody took it as their personal tragedy. We actually voted and we elected this person. And then we felt that we were robbed, that he was stolen from us. Due to political reasons.
The Kremlin's reaction. There's no smoke without fire. This week, President Putin's point man in the region claimed that police wouldn't have arrested a governor if they didn't have a cast-iron reason for it. Some believe that the real reason is Mr. Forgal's strained relations with the Kremlin. He's not from Mr. Putin's party. But could there be another explanation?
It's so important for the Kremlin to demonstrate their strength rather than weakness.
Political analyst Nikolai Petrov believes that the story of the Khabarovsk governor is a cautionary tale for all regional governors in Russia. To fight coronavirus, the Kremlin had given them all extra powers. This is a reminder. Who's boss?
I would look at this as political repression. It should be a signal sent to regional elites, to regional governors, to demonstrate that Kremlin is back in power and it's mastering the house. But the Kremlin did underestimate the negative reaction in case of Khabarovsk.
On Khabarovsk beach by the Amur River, it's a more peaceful scene. Sunbathing, sandcastles and swimming. But when I mention Moscow here, a big cloud comes over the conversation. We have a saying here, Natalia says, God and Moscow are far away. Moscow won't help us. We have to help ourselves. The arrest of their governor is fueling resentment of their capital, of Moscow, seven time zones to the west, a world away from here.
Steve Rosenberg reporting. Now, here's a first in the UK. A magazine specifically for young black children was launched this month. There are two of them, Coco Girl and Coco Boy, and they've been created by a London mother who wanted to empower black children around the world with pictures of them in it, plus information on black historical figures. Connie Sharp spoke to Selena Boyd, who says the idea started after her six-year-old daughter, Faith, kept saying to her, "I don't like what I look like. I don't like my hair."
Faith was in a school where she was the only black girl in her class. So she was experiencing children just saying things pertaining to her skin colour, just saying funny comments about her hair. But the biggest thing, I think, was how the teachers handled her. I remember going into her school for parents' evening and looking up at a display which was about the children in year one. And they had all the children that were white pictured on this display. And then they had a cutout of, I didn't know what it was, because the colour of this cutout was very dark. The skin colour blended in with the hair. The lips were very red and the eyes were really white. And Faith ran into the hall where I was standing looking at this cutout with my mouth open thinking, what is this? And she said, mummy, that's me. My teacher painted that. That's me. And I felt that that school in particular needed to know how to be inclusive, and they constantly reminded Faith that she was different through just the little things that they were doing. So I approached the head teacher and spoke to the head teacher about it. And at the time, she didn't get why I felt the way I felt. And she had to ask, I think, a teaching assistant, was there anything wrong with the image? And the teaching assistant, who was the only black teacher in the school, said yes, she found there was a problem with it, with the skin tone that was used. And it wasn't a particularly nice display because Faith already felt like she was out of place anyway, but that made her feel even more out of place. And there was another way they could have handled that display.
And it's interesting, isn't it? It's about explaining mm-hmm. racism to people who don't understand, who've never had the experience of it, really. And yeah. This magazine then, was it about empowering Faith? Or was it about making sure that Faith was very clear on what the non-stereotypes of a black person was?
Yeah, I think it's both, because I wanted Faith to see amazing people like Mary C. Cole or Martin Luther King. I wanted her to learn about the black history leaders from the past and the remarkable things that they had done. And I just think it's so easy for black history to be lost.
So yeah. How far have you come with that education, and where is Faith now in her little life of trying to understand, you know, what her identity is and who she is and, you know, this history that she belongs to?
She has learned to love who she is. She's also has learned the beauty of just researching her history, her culture, embracing her hair for what it is. So the beauty of me seeing Faith just style her hair and experiment with it is something that she never used to do. And also we show her lots of role models that are around now, from TV presenters to writers. She likes Maya Angelou, the poet. But yeah, we're just always surrounding her with her culture and with remarkable people as well that have made a difference.
That was Selena Boyd, a founder of the new children's magazines Coco Girl and Coco Boy, speaking to Carney Sharp. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
For 2,000 years, all non-human animals have been seen not as persons who have the capacity for rights, but as things who don't have any capacity for rights at all.
Why a campaign group in the United States is waging a legal battle on behalf of animals in captivity. Back now to the subject of the coronavirus. In Brussels, EU leaders are meeting in person in their face masks for the first time since the pandemic began. They're talking about how to spend 750 billion or so euros to help soften the economic impact of the coronavirus lockdowns. As we record this podcast, it looks likely that there are going to be some big disagreements between the countries taking part. The European Council President, Charles Michel, said he was hopeful, though, that the negotiations would succeed.
We have worked very hard in order to prepare this summit. I know that it will be very difficult because it's not only about money. It's about people, about European future, about our unity. And even if it's difficult, I'm convinced that with political courage, it's possible to reach an agreement.
What then are the differing sides of the argument? Our Europe reporter Gavin Lee took me through them.
If we just lay out what's at stake, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, you know, ahead of this summit, saying this is the biggest crisis that Europe has ever faced with COVID-19, therefore this is the most important meeting, because this is about the future of the Union, echoed by Emmanuel Macron as well, the French President, saying if they don't get the right figure here, it's not just the countries, it's the people, the workers, who won't be able to cope in the long run. So they're talking about two things. One is just 750 billion euros worth of a recovery fund, of which 500 billion euros is due to be dished out as grants for countries that most need it. So Spain, Italy and the likes. But that is still a problem, because they've been discussing this issue with all the Sherpas, all of the civil servants for many weeks now, months in fact, and they can't get an agreement because the Dutch, the Austrians, the Swedish and the Danes are still saying that they don't want to give grants. Now, the Dutch today have gone a step further. Mark Rutte saying that if the Dutch can have their say, as in if the Spanish, the Italians, for example, would commit to certain labour reforms, to commit to make sure this is a one-off, they wouldn't have to offer a grant again, and the Dutch could sign off on it, then perhaps they could agree to it. But that's not going down well. That's not the way the EU works. And briefly, they've all gone in their masks, 50 shades and shapes of different masks this morning, but the masks have come off already, because Andrej Babiš, the Czech Republic Prime Minister, has said that he doesn't like how these negotiations are going. He doesn't like the fact that some countries like the Dutch are able to keep a rebate from what they put in. So look, it's going to be a long one.
Gavin Lee speaking to me from Brussels. As EU leaders continue their efforts to agree on their own recovery package, the UN is calling on them and other rich countries to donate more than $10 billion to help developing nations battle the coronavirus pandemic. Otherwise, it says, they won't have enough money to feed their populations, threatening tens of millions of people with starvation. Andrew Walker is our economics correspondent.
The kind of money that the UN's Mark Lowcock has been talking about is really quite small in comparison with the amount of money that developed economies are spending on their own crisis. He's suggesting a figure of $10 billion. The United States alone, in terms of one very large piece of legislation known as the CARES Act, the figure there is more than $2 trillion. And if you look again, another way of comparing the thing is to look at what the main aid donor countries typically spend in a year on their aid programs. Most recent figures are in the order of $150 billion. So I think there's no question that the money could be found if they really needed to. They are already, as Mr. Lowcock has said, blowing aside their own fiscal rules, and they're borrowing far in excess of what they would like to do under normal circumstances. And across the whole of the developed world, the impact of an additional $10 billion would really be quite small. That said, any finance minister is always going to want to think about priorities, and you have to say that politically your own country is typically going to be the priority, especially when facing such a crisis as we have now. And with aid spending, there are always voices raising questions about whether one can be sure that the money is really being effectively spent.
Sure, Andrew. And I suppose if the richer nations don't dig their hands into their pockets, couldn't poorer nations in these times of low interest rate borrow the money themselves, or is that not really an option?
Well, sometimes they can. Certainly the extent to which developing countries as a whole have been making use of international financial markets has increased quite markedly in the last couple of decades. But Mr. Lowcock was talking specifically about low-income countries. They have much less access to international financial markets, and many of them have already been going to the International Monetary Fund for emergency assistance, specifically in the context of the crisis. So the extent to which those countries that Mr. Lowcock is talking about could do what you suggest, I think, is very, very limited.
Our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker there. It's 250 years since Captain James Cook arrived in Australia, claiming the country for the British. The subsequent colonial settlement has had devastating consequences for the people who'd lived there for more than 50,000 years. Huge numbers of Australia's Aboriginal people were murdered or locked up and had their land or children taken away from them. Many argue that even today, in a modern independent Australia, the violence of that colonisation continues. Sharma Khalil reports from Sydney.
Keenan Mundine is spending the afternoon out with his two little boys. The playground isn't far from where he grew up, but it's a far cry from his own childhood.
There's a building behind me where the most notorious sort of police brutality happened.
We meet in his old neighbourhood in inner-city Sydney. This is where Keenan was taken into care aged six. It's where he lost both his parents, his father to suicide, his mother to a drug overdose. By age 14, he was locked up in juvenile detention for theft and spent much of the next 15 years behind bars. Keenan says the justice system has unfairly targeted young Aboriginal people like him for years.
I live in constant fear of my children being put in the same positions that I was and traumatising them for the rest of their life.
Indigenous Australians are the most incarcerated people anywhere in the world. They make up less than 3% of the population, but represent more than a quarter of adult prisoners here. And in youth detention, more than half the children locked up in this country are Aboriginal. If you're an Indigenous teenage boy, you're more likely to go to jail than to university.
Police in the early days of colonisation were the ones who were enforcing the dispossession of our people from our lands onto missions.
Roxanne Moore is the executive officer of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services.
This is not in the past for us. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia, we feel the impact and the legacy of colonisation every single day, particularly in the justice system and in the extraordinary rates of black deaths in custody. Black
Lives Matter! The death of George Floyd in the United States brought the anger about mass incarceration and police brutality back to the fore. There are now calls for empowering Indigenous people to make the decisions that affect their community. Some projects are getting government funding, though Keenan's small charity that tries to keep young people away from prison relies heavily on donations. He takes me to meet Chase and Malachi, a couple of the teenagers he works with.
There's a lot of stuff that happens around here. There's a lot of people on drugs, a lot of crime. A lot of our family members have gone through that path and done that, and we don't want to follow that. And we want to work and get our own jobs, and we want to learn and succeed in school and go to university.
These young people are hoping to change the narrative and for their future to be different from their ancestors' past.
Shaima Khalil reporting. Now, you may well have heard of Happy the elephant, but according to a growing lobby of supporters, the 49-year-old animal, who's been in solitary confinement at the Bronx Zoo in New York for 13 years or so, is anything but happy. The New York Times calls her the world's loneliest elephant. And in the last few days, the Non-Human Rights Project, that's an organisation that seeks legal rights for certain animals, filed its appeal in its habeas corpus case on behalf of the wild-born Asian elephant, which they describe as unlawfully imprisoned. Alan Kasuja found out more from Steve Weiss, founder and president of the project.
This case has been going on for the last 2 years, but it's simply the latest case in a long-term series of strategic cases that the Non-Human Rights Project has been filing. We're now in our seventh year.
Now, when you say strategic cases, presumably you're trying to change the existing jurisprudence, the existing legal thinking. Is that right?
That's right. We're trying to have courts declare that our non-human animal clients, first chimpanzees, now an elephant, are legal persons, which means they have the capacity for rights. And we specifically ask them for the right to bodily liberty that's protected by a writ of habeas corpus. And we try to remove them from the prison that they're in and send them to a sanctuary.
Now, for those who don't know what habeas corpus is, it's basically an order by the court to allow prisoners to challenge the legality of their detention.
It is. And that's exactly what habeas corpus is.
And so in this particular case, you argue that what? That Happy the elephant is being detained illegally?
That's exactly what we're arguing, that Happy has been detained on 1 acre of land for 40 years in the Bronx Zoo, and that Happy is an extraordinarily cognitively complex being to the point of being autonomous, and that as an autonomous being, she should be entitled to the bodily liberty that's protected by a writ of habeas corpus. For 2,000 years, all non-human animals have been seen not as persons who have the capacity for rights, but as things who don't have any capacity for rights at all. And so our argument that Happy should have the right to bodily liberty protected by habeas corpus is something that's new because no one has ever asked that an elephant have any kind of legal right at all before.
And if you're successful, how will zoos be impacted? Do you think we'll begin to see the end of zoos? Because a lot of zoos are restricted. They're confined to very little spaces and have quite a few animals.
Actually, we're already beginning to start to see the end of zoos being able to hold captive such really extraordinarily cognitively complex beings as the great apes, as elephants, and orcas, whales, dolphins. They should not be held in captivity either.
Steve Weiss, founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, speaking to Alan Kasuja. And in a statement earlier this year, the Bronx Zoo said that it takes excellent care of Happy and will continue to do so along with all the animals here at the zoo. Her well-being is assured by our dedicated staff and all the expertise they bring in providing excellent care for her for more than 40 years. Now, before we go, it's time for News from Elsewhere, our weekly look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. Joining me is Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring, which follows news media in dozens of languages. Martin, I gather you've got a couple of stories about how people have been overcoming some of the obstacles the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown in their way.
Yes. A group of young travelling musicians found their path barred when Turkey closed its borders. So rather than heading for Georgia or Iran, they actually took to the hills and moved into an empty house in a mountain village near the Black Sea. The group is called Tango Maluco, and it's made up of two Argentinian brothers, hence the tango, and their Spanish and Swiss girlfriends. And one of them, Miriam Ellenbrock, told us that they found the house through Turkish friends and that the villagers took them to their hearts, which is rather nice. And for the last few months, they've been growing their own food and learning how to make yogurt, cook local delicacies, and even pick tea with their hosts. Now, in turn, they've been putting on concerts in the village and are planning to perform in the next district too. And Miriam says that even with the borders reopening again, they are in no hurry to get back to Europe.
Great story. And I suppose a lot of people's wedding plans have been put on hold during this coronavirus era that we're in. But apparently one couple in Scandinavia managed to find an unusual way to get married after all, didn't they?
That's right, yes. Now, what made the challenge all the greater for them is that the bride is Norwegian and her groom is Swedish. And because Sweden has taken a much more relaxed approach to COVID restrictions, neighbouring countries like Norway have not included it in the list of destinations that people can travel from. So what the couple did was they stood in a forest on opposite sides of the border, just separated by a white ribbon. And the bride, Camilla Oyard, said that postponing the wedding was never an option, and she'd suggested getting married at the border just as a joke. And her groom, Alexander Klern, said they didn't think anyone would even come, as it's a long drive into the woods, but they were delighted by a big turnout of friends and family. And there were two uninvited guests as well, police officers, who were there to make sure that no one crossed the ribbon.
Thanks, Martin, for that. That was Martin Morgan from our monitoring team, bringing us this week's news from elsewhere. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.